business today, we've got House File 392, which is a federal conformity bill, partial federal conformity bill, and we have an overview of the property tax system by the department. So I think we'll start with the property tax system. Mr. Volkman? Mr. Haugen? And members, you have a PowerPoint. What you see up on the screen, I think we have in our packets. Is that correct?
Everybody have
color copies.
Oh, we pushed it hard this morning. We got it done. The power went out last night at the department. It was a little more of a helter-skelter this morning than anticipated.
Did the wind quit blowing?
Yeah, right. Well, Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Gordon Folkman. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division, and next to me is John Hagen, who is the assistant director for assessment and classification. We were asked to give an overview of the determination of the property tax and focus on the role that valuation plays. And I think this is an important discussion. There's a lot of misinformation and confusion about how the property tax is computed and the role that valuation does play. We're going to do a couple things here for the committee, and I'm going to start off with a general overview of the process and show generally where the valuation piece fits in. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the shifting issues that go on. I think one of the questions that were raised, and it's raised amongst the general public too a lot, is that why do my valuations go down in this market, yet I still see my taxes go up? And we'll try and clarify that for a little bit here too. Then we'll get into a little bit more detailed discussion about the assessment practices, role of the appraiser, role of the assessor, look at some of the CI appraisal practices. Focus a little bit on the foreclosure, especially in this market. Foreclosures are playing an important role. And am I missing something else on the overview? That's it. And, so that's what we're going to try and cover today. So I'm going to try and go through the first part. And there is the agenda. I will be doing the overview of the tax shift and role valuation. John will do assessment practices, and we'll have a discussion about commercial industrial and end with a discussion of foreclosures. First, as you know, Minnesota's property tax system is complicated. In theory, it's a simple calculation of tax equals base times rate. But in practice in Minnesota, we make it a little bit more complicated to address issues of fairness. I like this sequence of slides. What makes the property tax system complicated? Well, first of all, you have to think about it. There's over 3,474 overlapping jurisdictions throughout the state, comprised of one state, 1,783 townships. I have to change my glasses. 1,783 townships, 855 cities, 87 counties, 341 school districts, and 408 special districts. The financing for these jurisdictions comes from state and local taxes, exemptions, deductions in the property tax system, intergovernmental aids, and what's not listed there, of course, are own source fees and charges, etc. The system is complicated by a very extensive classification system, resulting in multiple classes, and we have also multiple tax bases as well. There are numerous laws and regulations defining property tax valuation. If you look at tax bills that are passed year after year, usually the property tax provisions account for most of the changes that are done every year in tax committee. Levy limits, truth in taxation, and even there's a lengthy administrative time period. And when you think about when information is first needed to try and do a sales study to determine valuation of property, going through the levy determination period, abatements, property tax refund, any one tax year could have an administrative time period of 2.5 to 3 years to complete it. The next slide gives you I'm going to go through a quick process of how the taxes are computed. And the idea here is to illustrate where the role of valuation fits into the overall process. Box one is basically where the system starts, where the assessor starts to do an estimate of valuation of property in any one jurisdiction. Keep in mind that the valuation is of the previous year to the tax year that's in play. This also creates an issue with respect to taxpayers being able to understand why their value does not necessarily correspond to the taxable payable year, but in today's market there's a concern about why their value might be lagging behind the real perception of what their value is given the current market. So there is this lag issue that's in place, and we'll get into a little bit more of that when we get to the more discussion of the assessment practices. Another part of the valuation or the tax capacity side of the calculation is once you have valuation of the property, you look at the class rates that are in statute. The class rates are multiplied by the market value. You come up with tax capacity for each of the parcels and then aggregated within the parcels to come up with a jurisdiction-wide level of tax capacity. Then we get into the separate. There's a separate levying process. And keep in mind, this is very important, that the levy process is separate from the valuation process. A lot of people, as we'll talk about a little bit later in terms of looking at some of the shift issues, many people, again, think that when my valuation changes, there will be a corresponding change in value. That's not necessarily true because the two systems or the two processes are separate. After the valuation is determined, the tax capacity is determined for the various jurisdictions, the local government budget process tries to determine how much property tax revenue it needs to operate. Local spending for schools, cities, counties, and townships are factored in, their needs, their wants, etc. They look at non-property tax revenues, intergovernmental aids, fees, charges, and usually what happens in the budget process, the gap between what is needed for local spending to address needs versus what they can gather from their local own source revenues is what they end up trying to levy for their budget purposes. Once the levy is determined, the levy is divided into tax capacity to come up with the tax rate. And that tax rate then is used to spread to other individual properties to raise revenue from the individual parcels. Now you take the same process on the value of the taking the valuation of the individual property and look at the tax capacity you do the total property tax rate, sum for each local taxing jurisdiction. Now you have that rate, and you can go to the individual parcel. So if you go to the individual home, commercial property, rental property, etc., you now are trying to look at and apply the valuation and tax capacity at the individual parcel level and applying a tax rate. So you look at the parcel tax capacity as a function of taking the individual market value times that parcel, that class rate for that type of property, and you multiply it times the tax rate there in box 7, and you get a preliminary gross tax. You then, for homesteads, for example, you are able to subtract out the market value credit. For ag property, there's an ag credit, and there's a number of other credits coming into play as well. You end up with a preliminary tax. The preliminary tax is then put into the T&T process, parcel specific. We then have T&T hearings throughout the state, and the local jurisdictions get feedback on that, can make a final determination of levy. And once that levy is determined, that's the levy that's ultimately raised and sent out to the individual taxpayer. And in the final analysis, if the individual taxpayer is eligible for the property tax refund, they can file for the refund. So you can see the process is a quite lengthy and complicated one. I try to summarize it here for you. But the key message here is that the evaluation process is a separate process from the levy determination. So why property taxes vary from year to year? Many factors contribute to the change that people see, the individual change in value for the individual property. As you'll see, too, the change in value for your neighbor's property may also affect your property tax. The change in levy, as determined by the county, city, school district, etc. Voters may approve a school referendum. Federal state mandates may result in higher spending requirements at the local level. The state legislature may change property class rates. Special assessments may come into play and on your tax bill. And changes in tax laws, like fiscal disparities, tax increment financing, can also have interacting effects. And this is just a brief summary. So there are a lot of things going on. That's why I sort of like that map with all the equations going around. It's very difficult to explain to taxpayers exactly what is driving and changing any individual tax bill.
Mr. Chair?
Sir Limmer.
Going back to your last slide.
Yeah.
When you talked of federal mandates, could you give me an example of a federal mandate that would affect our local property taxes?
Well, I'm not an expert in a lot of especially in the highway or correction areas, but I'm sure there's probably some programs that are required, especially for counties to meet certain expenditures, that they have to do some matching. But not off the top of my head, I'm not necessarily aware of specific program, Senator, but
so
there's a number of them, I'm sure.
So, Mr. Chair, it wouldn't be a federal decision that would necessarily affect directly that property. It would be an equation of sorts that if a local, some other local political subdivision were required to pay something, a mandate from the federal government, to get a matching fund or something, then that may trigger the total expense of, a county, and then they have to slide the burden over to the property tax payer.
I think you're right. The extent to which any federal or state mandate requires any direct property tax increase, most likely there is a revenue stream that local jurisdictions are looking at, and to the extent that other resources aren't necessarily available, property tax becomes one of those mechanisms. Same thing with the LGA and other types of aid programs. It's indirectly associated with those, trying to figure out how you finance those costs.
And, Mr. Chair, then let's say it was a county. It would be the county commissioner's decision whether or not they should add that to the property tax burden of the taxpayer or try to absorb it somewhere in their existing budget.
Correct. I think that's true.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Folkman, with the decline in property values, and I know my house has taken at least $100,000 hit, if not more, counties aren't going to reduce their budgets, and they're not going to probably reduce our property taxes. What's going to happen? Where is that adjustment going to take place?
Well, I have some examples I'm going to run through, and I think we can give you some idea of what the potential levers or mechanisms that can come into play to adjust for that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
Because when I'm reading through it, it said something in there about shifting on one property to another, and then you're suggesting there's other changes, so you're going to show us what those other changes
might be. Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, I think I want to have several examples which specifically shows you under different scenarios how that shifting can occur, and included in that are certain assumptions that may or may not come into play with how local governments will adjust their tax rate or levy level from one year to the next. So hopefully after I go through those examples, I might be able to show you how that shifting works. Now I got a
assessment.
In your packet, there's a couple of charts that look like this. It's entitled Property Tax Shift Examples. I have four scenarios. Does everybody have that on your sheet?
Yeah.
If you look at the first one, what I'm doing here is I establish a hypothetical community having three types of property, a homestead, a residential rental, and a business property. I first want to establish the base year, the first year in which levies or property taxes are being raised from local jurisdictions spread on these three properties. For purposes here, to keep it fairly simple, the values for the respective types of property are the same. $200,000 for the homestead, residential rental, and the business. So a total market value for the tax for this hypothetical jurisdiction totals $600,000. And you can see that up in your upper left-hand corner. Under our current property tax system, we have these classification rates. And for simplicity purposes, I kept it pretty simple here. 1% on the first, 1% for the homestead, a 1.25 for the residential rental, and sort of a blended rate that's from current law, about a 1.75 for the business. And for each of the property types there, you have to then compute the tax capacity for those types of property. Because you can see back, it's reflecting that flow chart that I quickly went through with you just a few minutes ago. You take the market value times the class rate, that gives you your tax capacity value for the homestead of $2,000, $2,500 for the rental property, and $3,500 for the business property. If you add that up to get the jurisdictional total, that's $8,000. If you go up to the upper left-hand corner, you see the total of $8,000 for the tax capacity. For purposes of this example, we'll say that the levy that's being raised from these three types of property is $9,000. And that's reflecting hypothetically, the levies from for the school district, city, county, that kind of thing. So it's an overlapping type of jurisdictional or total amount. You come up with a tax rate. You take the $9,000 into the tax capacity, and that gives you a tax rate of 1.13. That tax rate, then, is the tax rate that's applied to the jurisdiction to all properties in that unique taxing jurisdiction. And that 1.13, then, is shown in the chart below here. You take that rate times the tax capacity, and you have a total tax of $2,250 for the homestead, $2,813 for the residential property, and $3,938 for the business. And again, that totals to the $9,000 that the levy was supposed to raise. Keep in mind, too, another thing to keep to help you think about the shifting issue is I've also included there the relative share of the tax base for each of the three properties. In this case, it's 25% for the homestead, 31.3% is accounted for by the residential rental property, and 43.8% from the business property. So that's the base year. So if we go into the next year, a growth scenario, in other words, what happens? And under the first one here, I'm doing a growth scenario where all property values decrease by 5%, and for purposes for the first example, there is no change in levy. A lot of times when I've given this example in the past, I would use a growth of 5 or 10%, but in today's market, I thought a decline would be more appropriate. In this case, we have each property type decreasing by 5%. From a taxpayer's point of view, they see a valuation decline, and they may be anticipating that their property taxes will correspondingly go down as well. But in this case, because all properties are declining at the same rate, you'll see that there's absolutely no change in tax distribution if their levy stays the same. For example, the $200,000 for each of the properties dropped to $190,000. The class rates remain the same. The tax capacity now has dropped, however, because the tax capacity has declined. It's now $1,900 for the homestead, $2,375 for the residential rental, and $3,325 for the business, or $7,600. It was under the base year, tax capacity was $8,000. Because of the 5% decline, it's now down to $7,600. As a result, the same amount of levy has to be raised, but the levy tax rate has now increased. So now the properties are exposed to a higher tax rate. It's 1.18% now as opposed to 1.13. So you take that higher rate, apply to the lower tax capacity, and because all properties had the same relative decline in value, there was no change in tax. And the relative share of the taxes remain the same as well. Go to the second example. Same base year scenario implies, but under this growth scenario, only the homestead value declines by 5%. But the rental and residential property and business property values stay the same. So if you drop down here to that base, the growth scenario part of the chart, homestead now has gone down to $190,000 in market value, and the rental residential stayed at $200,000. The tax capacity, when you factor in the class rates now, is no longer $8,000, but it's now $7,900, so there's less of a drop than we saw in the first example, but a drop nonetheless of 1.13%. That resulted in a higher tax rate of 1.14 to raise the same levy. Again, this example has no change in the local levy. That higher tax rate then is applied to the new tax capacities as a result of the growth in the tax, change in the tax base. Only the homestead's tax capacity declined, and the other two types of properties, their tax capacity remained the same. So they have the same base year tax capacity and a slightly higher tax rate. So there is the shift. The 1.14% resulted in a 3.8% reduction or $85 reduction in the homestead tax, but the other two properties, which did not experience any change in value because of that higher tax rate being applied to that same tax capacity from the previous year, their taxes actually went up by 1.3%. And this is what creates some confusion with taxpayers. They see their values go down, and all of a sudden they see their taxes go up. And in this scenario, there was no change in local levy. It was all being done in the tax-based environment. And what makes it even more kind of complicated is that in this example, we're just changing the estimated market value. As you well know, you could have a number of other tax provisions that come into play that would affect that tax capacity. We could have a change in the class rates. We could have some exemption change in exemption laws. Anything that affects certain properties' taxable tax capacity potentially has the impact of shifting taxes onto other property. Yes, Senator?
Senator Limmer?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In this scenario, could you have the spending in these political subdivisions going down and still having a tax increase?
Yes, you could.
Do you have an example of that?
I could do it right here if you would like. Let's see here. Let's take Senator, do you want an example where the levy goes down, but the property taxes on the properties may go up? Is that what you're wanting to do? Mm-hmm.
The levy going down is assuming that it's following the spending pattern,
mm-hmm.
and that we don't need to have that much money in the system, and how it would have an effect the bottom line of the taxpayer. You can understand how difficult it is to explain this when you're at a town hall meeting. Having an example of having the political subdivisions doing everything they can to keep their costs down, maybe even going down, but then try to explain that to the property taxpayer of saying something to the effect, don't worry, it's working the way it should.
Senator Limmer, a longtime member of the Senate told me one time that if somebody wants to talk about the property tax system, rather than explain the system to them, tell them they're too high and move on.
Yeah.
I'm trying to come up with a scenario here which wouldn't be necessarily realistic of today's market, but for the heck of it here, I have the levy going down from, remember, under the base year, we had $9,000 for the property tax levy. I brought it down by 5% to $8,500. In this example, the homestead taxes, instead of declining, I'm having it increased by 10%. For the other properties, they dent down by 5%. So the homestead goes from $200,000 up to $220,000. The other two types of property go from $200,000 to $190,000. You do the tax capacity calculation, and you end up with, now because of the change in levy and the change in tax base, the tax rate has actually gone down from 1.13 to 1.08, but because there's more value now in that homestead tax, because their value went up, their taxes have gone up 5.8%, but the other jurisdictions, other properties within that jurisdiction have gone down, because there's been a shift in the share of the tax.
Right, exactly.
Senator Limmer, that's what people need to learn how to understand.
Well, Mr. Chair, in this example, homes are not going up by 10% in value. They're going down 10% in value every year consistently for about 3 or 4 years. We're at that. We're progressing through this cycle. So despite the fact that some cities are trying to cut their budgets, the property values continue to go down, and yet their bottom line taxes continue to rise.
Senator Limmer, I mean, Mr. Volkman, correct me if I'm wrong, but depending on the mix of your properties, mm-hmm. I mean, if you have a community that's all homesteads and the values are going down, well, then you're not going to see tax reductions. But if you have a, you know, one of the classes of property that might be going up, if you have a lot of CI and it's actually holding stable or going up, then the property taxes will go down on the homes. So, I mean, it's that mix of property that really drives the shifting.
I'm not sure if we're seeing any property values going up right now. We've got, at least in the suburban part of Minnesota, we've got office buildings that are becoming more and more vacant every month.
Mr. Chair, I put another example here real quick to have all the property values go down under this example. The levy reduction, instead of being 5% that I just showed you, I now say it's only down gone. It's gone down 2%. So the levy has gone from $9,000 to $8,820, a decline of about 2%. And now under this example, we have declines in value for the homestead, rental, and business property. We have the homestead going down 2%, the rental residential down 5%, and the business property going down 10%. Under these examples now, the levy for the local jurisdiction has gone down, values have gone down, and the tax has increased for the homestead of 2.6%. And the reason that's happening is that the homestead value went down less than the rental and business property, and it went down, it went down at the same rate that the overall levy went down, but because the other two properties in this jurisdiction dropped at a bigger rate, it shifted more tax back onto the home. And that's what's hard to talk to taxpayers about.
Mr. Chair, just you don't have to make up a scenario here, but if the political subdivisions decided to lower their levy more, they could eventually, despite the fact that there's lowering of market value, you will get to a point where that formula, bottom line, does not have an increase in the property tax. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think, you know, local jurisdictions, that the decision to actually what to set their levy at, mm-hmm. I think primarily is driven by what they think they need to do budgetarily. I know that a lot of jurisdictions like to get some preliminary information about what's going on with their tax base, and the mix of property is going to be very important. When you have a jurisdiction with a lot of commercial, industrial, rental, residential, you're always going to have a lot of different scenarios sitting out there. But I think that to some extent, jurisdictions probably do factor in what's happening in the community, what's happening with their tax base, and what would be politically tolerable for their levy to be raised, and what the tax consequences of that may be for their taxpayers to bear. But I think because of the timing of the information, it's not readily available to really know exactly what's going to happen. That's part of the TNT process. The TNT process gives gives the local officials some idea of what they're levying and what the implications of that levy will be for the jurisdictions within their state, and they can come back and, through the hearing process, make adjustments. So there is, it's that back and forth going on.
So, Mr. Chair, what you're telling me is, despite the difficulty of trying to read the tea leaves for budgets, it may be possible to do that. The answer is yes?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, I would add, you know, again, the relationship of the change in the tax base and what local jurisdictions need, there's going to be that calculus. And part of the property tax, unlike the income and sales tax, which you have a fixed rate, and as the change in tax base generates X amount of revenue, the property tax, the levy itself, is a budgetary decision. And just like it's a budgetary decision set here in the state capitol, trying to figure out how much money you need to spend. To some extent, I would imagine that local officials take into consideration what's happening in their local tax base.
Senator Squick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to say that you needed to head to that type of scenario in order to get the result. But the other thing that we're going to learn as we get to the assessing part of this is that why the homeowner's value has dropped in the market today, it's not necessarily going to get reflected in their taxable value for a time period, maybe a year or more, depending on how long it takes for the sales to work into the sales ratio, which further complicates it. But we're going to get to that later on.
Yep. And for speeding up, the last example I had here was a scenario where the levy did go up by 6%, and the value changes in the three property types declined, one by 5%, one by 8%, and one by 7%. And here's a situation where you have the levy increasing by 6%, and there's a different change in value occurring with the three different types of property, and you get quite different scenarios with respect to the increase in person's tax. So here's a homeowner experiencing a 5% decline in value as it appears on their tax statement. They know that local levies have gone 6%, but their taxes have gone up 8.1% as a result of all the interactions going on. So this gets to one of my other favorite slides. Senator Limmer, you said how difficult it is to talk to taxpayers, and trust me, it is tough, and you can see why. In this cartoon, we're just simply saying when you're trying to explain the system to the property owner and all the different factors that are coming into play, it is quite difficult to explain unless you're a seasoned tax analyst.
Mr. Volkman, do we have the artist in-house over at the department?
yeah, sort of. I must confess, this is a cut and paste from the Far Side, so it's plagiarism. Another way I like to think of it is it's the property tax system's like pickup sticks. And whether you're talking about an economic change in the tax base because the valuation changes or tax law changes that affect the taxable value of property, one change is always going to affect other properties. And so if you think of the property tax system as a layering of sticks, and then there's a sleight of hand coming in play here, and that hand is either the economic forces coming into play in terms of changing valuations amongst the different types of property, or changing class rights, it's legislative tax policy, for example. When those things change because of the interactions, any one change is going to have multiple effects on other property. And this is why we tend to do a lot of property tax modeling. Maybe some would say maybe too much modeling because we let legislators know what the implications are. But Jack Paulson, who sits back there in a very quiet way, goes back and looks at tax bills and models them. We do it in the House research. We do it in revenue. And their model is designed to come up with a measuring of the shift. And so we have a tax shiftograph that comes out of those models to let legislators know how their policy changes have an effect. Not only targeted the relief to the principal property type that the legislation was trying to get at, but how that change affects other property.
Mr. Volkman, if you could make that hand grab that stick and move it. You'd greatly improve your presentation.
Oh.
It's close.
You didn't move?
Senator Johnson. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Folkman, I appreciate the shift examples, and I looked through the packet again, and I don't want to jump ahead again, but if I think that the residential property is going down by 25%, not 5 or 7 or 8 or 10. I think it's at least at 25% right now. And I do appreciate what Senator Scoy said about the assessments haven't caught up to it, but when I look at my assessment, it's there. So I see potentially a crisis that these shifts aren't going to adjust for.
Well, one thing, Senator, if we went back to I got to put my other glasses on. That's the problem. We went back to this first example, and not even think about the shifting that's going on, but let's put in place a scenario where the levies are staying constant. Again, maybe what Senator Limmer was saying, maybe the local jurisdictions are trying to factor in that the amount of levy that they're going to need to operate is going to have to remain frozen from one year to the next. But you have this underlying change in the tax base. And for purposes here, let's just say that we put in a more exaggerated change in the base. Let's say it's 15%. I'm not sure. We can do 25%. Let's do 20%. And we'll do first across the board for each property type the same. And again, what's happening is that because all the properties experience the same 20% decline in value and the levy stayed the same, the tax rate goes from 1.13% all the way up to 1.4, but that 1.4 is now applied to a much lower tax capacity because of the 20% reduction in value, and the change in tax, there isn't any because there was an even distribution of the change in value amongst the property. The problem that might occur is that depending on the mix of property in any one jurisdiction, if you have a 20% drop in homes and there's only a 5% drop, a 5% drop in rental and maybe a 10% drop in commercial, you now have and the levy has to increase by 8%. You have, again, homesteads came down much lower than the other property types, so they would actually experience, out of a 15% reduction in levy, it's only 3%. Because of the change in the tax rates that's going to occur. But the other two properties got the shift. They got an increase of 15.2 and 9.1. I could reverse that and say rental residential went down 20% and business went down 20%, and then you'd see a bigger shift onto the homes. So the point is combination of the mix of property, how the valuations are changing amongst them, and that levy decision coming into play.
Mr. Volkman, that's kind of the LGA reduction scenario, where if the legislature reduces aids and credits and cities then are forced to levy that back, even with declining in market values, people are going to see their taxes go up.
And they would go up unevenly depending on the mix of property in the market, how it's playing with the different types of property. And we'll get into a little, in the assessment discussion, we'll get into that lag issue a little bit more in terms of what the issues are, because right now we still see a lot of people looking at their current perception of what the market's doing for their home, what they see in the real estate pages of the newspaper, and that lag on the assessment side is lagging behind that real-time perception.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other thing, Senator Johnson, for some communities, if part of their budget is an aid that's been reduced, then their levy will go up to make up that aid. So even though their budget was flat, you're going to see property taxes increase and the amount of money to the government doesn't change. And of course, that's the concern that we have with the reductions to local government aids and county program aids.
Mr. Chair, my last couple slides sort of sets the table for John to talk about the assessment practices. But in the state of Minnesota for 2009, we had approximately 2.7 million parcels. 5% of that was commercial. 70% of those parcels were residential. 17% ag, and about 8% cabin. This shows the growth rate of the major property types since 2000. As you can see, rental or residential property started to decline back in 2005. Ag property was increasing and has leveled off and dropped slightly in 2007. But it now it's plateaued a little bit. I would suspect we get into next year, it's going to be dropping. Commercial industrials or cabins were holding pretty good here, 20% per year, even for much of the decline in the rest of the market. But now they, too, are showing a decline. And residential, of course, is down here. And the commercial industrial now are also showing some declines. And, again, going back to that example, if all these different types of property had the same relative decline or growing at the same percentage point, that would minimize the shift. It's the problem is that the different types of property, the different parcels within a jurisdiction, they grow differently, and it creates some shifting.
Mr. Volkman, do you have any observations on why cabins, on there they reduced by 5%. Any observation as to why that happened?
I'll let some of the assessors maybe talk. I can only speculate that the market for the lakeshore property remained an attractive parcel.
And maybe I'll leave it for the assessors, but let me offer it so they can think about it. I think what happened, living on a lake, I think there were a lot of people that are of the age where their kids are now gone. They maybe don't quite have the use for the cabin that they did in years past, but have been hanging on to those properties because they've been going up 10, 15% a year. And finally, when it looked like prices were flattening off, their surplus of property actually came on the market kind of at the same time. And I know on Vermilion, where I live, there are over 100 parcels of property for sale. Not much is selling, but it really got on the market largely because people were riding that equity wave up. And when they saw it flatten off, they decided, well, if I'm not going to make any more money with it, I might as well take the money and put it in something else. I think it's some of it. So if the assessors could think
about it. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think the assessors could probably address that. And now that you mentioned it, it's something I often talk to with people about, too, is that property in this kind of market, they'll go on the market. They'll try and ask for a relatively high price, but doesn't sell as quick. So what you have is pent-up property waiting to be sold, and the question is how long will people keep it on the market? Once it starts coming back on, that's when you start seeing the decline in the value, possibly. My last chart, the other major component to looking at the assessment practices is the number of sales. The assessors are very dependent on looking at the sales to get a gauge as to what the market's doing. And just real quickly, you can see we had approximately 150 to 200,000 sales statewide in the early 2000s. That's now dropped down to about 100,000 in 2008. And the relative share of sales that are good sales for the sales studies has also declined. It used to be between the 46 and 48% and has now dropped down to 43%. So not only is the market declining and starting to decline across all property types, but the number of sales is also diminishing, and the quality of good sales is diminishing, meaning that it's making a much more difficult situation and complex one for the assessors. With that, Mr. Chair, I can turn it over to John.
Mr. Chair.
Assessors, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Folkman, could you just talk real briefly about what makes a sale a good sale?
That's going to come, Mr. Chair, Senator Spoy, that's going to come in our presentation.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is John Hagan. I'm Assistant Director of the Property Tax Division. Thank you for the opportunity to come here and talk about assessing. Mine gets a little sticky in places, but compared to Mr. Parker's presentation, it should be almost like dessert for you. The assessor has a great deal of duties and responsibilities. But I think, for the most part, you could break the primary duties of the assessor down into two primary functions. Establishing a market value for property and establishing a classification for the property. Now, I'm going to read a statutory definition of market value, which admittedly gets a little hard to wrap your head around. It requires, to satisfy the definition of market value, that the usual selling price at the place where the property to which the term is applied shall be at the time of the assessment, being the price which could be obtained at a private sale or an auction, if it is determined by the assessor that the price from the auction sale represents an arm's-length transaction, the price obtained at a forced sale shall not be considered. Now, admittedly, that is a really difficult concept to wrap your arms around. It's a lot of words that can be taken in their totality. It's hard to, at least it's hard for me to follow it conceptually. Part of that can be attributed to the fact that there's a requirement that in the statutory definition that we address components that are not necessarily evident every day in the definition of market value, like auction sales and things like that, that need to be put within the definition. So I find it a lot better and a lot more instructive, I think, to break down the various components of the definition for a property to satisfy the definition of market value. Some of the conditions that must be met for a property to satisfy the definition of market value is the buyer and seller are typically motivated. In other words, the seller can't be behind on their house payments or have lost their job in a position which would cause them to sell the property, be forced to sell the property. Or conversely, the buyer would not be in a position where they had to buy a house. They'd been moved into a community and had to buy a house in a very short period of time. That would not satisfy that component. Both properties are well-informed or well-advised. They both are acting in what... could you run the PowerPoint? Excuse me. Can't do two things at once. So
Mr. Hagan, before we leave the first slide, the one that was up there, A under Roman numeral 3, a fair assessment reflects the potential selling price of the property. Is there a period of time that assessors use that? I mean, is it 30 days? Is it 60 days? Is it not? What's a reasonable period of time that a property needs to sell in for the market value to accurately reflect its value?
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question, and it varies from community to community, and it varies from time to time. Some years ago, when the real estate market was hot in the area where I live, I would sometimes drive to work in the morning. There'd be no for sale sign, and I'd come home. There'd be a for sale sign. It would be sold already. So that when the real estate market was very, very hot, properties were selling incredibly fast. So in that community, you could almost argue a reasonable period of time would be 15 or 20 days. That's changed a lot now. There's for sale signs that have been there for months and months and months and months. So it does sort of depend on the community, and the assessor is bound to make a determination of what is the typical marketing time in that particular community to satisfy that. I'm guessing they're a lot longer in all communities now than they were a year or so ago.
Because it should have, there should be some reflection on the amount of time it takes to sell to reflect the market value. I suspect that's an area assessors have some discretion in.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. And as Mr. Fultman alluded to, that I think in the years I've been in property tax assessment, it seems like there's, when the market starts to deteriorate, as it has, and the media starts to talk about how values are going down, and a lot of people who hadn't planned to sell decide they'd better sell before things get worse, for example, or in your scenario on Lake Vermilion, where a lot of people that were riding the equity up decide to sell, a lot of those properties go on the market at a higher level, sort of the level that was established at the top of the market, and they sit there for a while. Nothing really happens. So you've got this protracted period of time where nothing really sells except the ones that are for sales. And then after a while, people can't hold them any longer, and they start to go down. Then you start to see the decline. So it's not an instantaneous thing where the market starts to go down and the sales follow it, in my opinion. And Mr. Austin may be addressing that, or certainly Mr. May will be in a few minutes. Both parties have to be well-informed and well-advised of the uses of the property, and they have to both be acting in their own best interest. For example, if a seller was selling a property and they knew a freeway was coming by their house shortly, that would be a negative effect. If the buyer wasn't aware of it, it would not satisfy that requirement. And conversely, if it was a commercial property, for example, and the buyer knew a freeway was coming by, which might actually enhance the property's value, and the seller was unaware of it, that would not satisfy that. So those sales would be outside of the norm.
Mr. Chair, to the witness, and I'm not sure if this is the case in a lot of cities, but have you ever heard of situations where 1031 transactions are believed to extraordinarily elevated levels in a city beyond what's reasonable from the standpoint of sales price?
Are those good sales, Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, Senator, my name is Larry Austin. I'm with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. I'm one of the regional reps, so I review the sales that come through. As a general rule, 1031 exchanges are considered good arm's length transactions, and they will be included in the sales study. However, they do have a fairly short window of time to identify properties when they're going to do a 1031 exchange, and then there's a six-month time period to actually close on that sale. And if they're getting towards the end of that 1031 time period, that six-month time period, and they have to do the exchange and they pay what we feel is considerably more than market for mm-hmm. that property, we will reject that sale from the study. But as a general rule, 1031 exchange sales are included in the sale study as good sales.
Mr. Chair,
and
just to follow up on that, would you believe that would be the general practice of assessors within any individual county in Minnesota to reject those sales? Because it doesn't seem to be happening in my county, but.
Mr. Chair, Sunder, I guess we'd have to have.
We'd have to talk individually offline.
Yeah,
okay.
Information on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to Senator Senjum, with regard to the 1031 sales, I actually had a bill to require the valuation to be reduced by the tax break that's afforded in that like transfer. In my discussion with the assessors, they told me that they are aware of these because a lot of people when they check their record, they have a reason for transfer on there, and sometimes they know what's going on. And what I was told is a lot of assessors do reduce the values. Is that, did I hear you say that or not? I heard you say that you might reject the sale.
Mr. Austin?
But my recollection was that some assessors said that they did reduce the value of the sale by some of that tax benefit.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I guess I'm not familiar with any specific cases where that has taken place. It's certainly possible, but as a general rule, the assessor would stick with the value that they had on it and just consider it either good for the study or bad for the study, depending on the individual situation or circumstances.
So, Mr. Austin, does the assessor have discretion to do that if he wants to?
Mr. Chair, any sales like that would be reviewed with the regional rep for that particular area. I work with the seven metro counties, the City of Minneapolis, Wright, Sherburn, and Goodhue County. So any sales like that would come through the study that would be questionable, I would discuss that with Mr. Atchison from Hennepin County, Minneapolis, wherever the sales happen to be. And we would make a decision as to whether or not we felt that the sale price was in the normal range of values, and if it was, it would be included in the study. If not, we would just reject it from the study because we don't want that influencing the valuations of other similar properties out there.
Senator Sundrum, does that help?
Yes, at least for the time being. I guess I need to talk a little bit more back home.
Mr. Hagan, go ahead.
One final condition of being acceptable for market value is that payment is made in cash or its equivalent, and that the financing terms are those that are generally available in that community. For it to be an arm's-length market value sale, the terms can't be overly generous, and conversely, they can't be overly burdensome. If all those terms are met and all those conditions are met, the property is felt to be a market value transaction. So I guess basically to cut through all some of the definitional stuff, the basic job of the assessor at its very root level would be to estimate what a typical buyer would pay for that property if it were to be put up for sale. There is also a requirement in law that the assessor, as a part of their valuation calculation, they determine a separate value for the land and the structures, with the total being reflective of the market value. Now, another concept that comes into play when the assessor is making a determination of value is the concept of highest and best use that there's been a lot of discussion at the legislature over the last few years. Typically, a property's highest and best use and the existing use are one and the same. And for most cases, the property is being used for its highest and best use. And highest and best use is being defined, it's another difficult concept or definition to listen to, but a concept in appraisal and an assessment law requiring that each property be appraised as though it were being put to its most profitable use given the probable legal, physical, and financial constraints. So again, I think it's easier to look at that through an example. For example, a house next to the Mall of America would likely not be the highest and best use of the house, even if it's being used as a house, would not be as a residential property. The highest and best use would likely be commercial. We've had a lot of discussion at the legislature the last few years about farms. Oftentimes the issues that get us in some of the difficulties in farm values are when farms are located next to an urban area or a lakeshore, and consequently when they're being used as a farm, that does not reflect their highest and best use. A problem we've encountered in the last 4 or 5 years is where the seasonal pressure on these farms is exceeding the value of the farm to the buyer, is exceeding the value of the worth to the farmer. So we do have that highest and best use issue showing a lot of problems throughout the state.
Mr. Hagan, if I have a farm close proximity to a lake or a body of water, and really the highest and best use might be seasonal rec, what if I have it enrolled in Green Acres?
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question. And the Green Acres would protect that farm if it was being farmed by the farmer and qualified for the Green Acres provisions. The farmer would be allowed, the assessor would basically calculate two values on the property. They calculate one value reflecting the highest and best use of the property as a seasonal property or for development purposes, and a second value reflecting the actual value of the property as a farm. And if the farmer was enrolled in the Green Acres program, they would be allowed to pay tax on the property as a farm until the property is sold. And then they have to pay a period of, depending on, in the past, they'd have to pay back a period of 3 years of property taxes.
And if it was just a farm and not enrolled in Green Acres, what would happen?
Mr. Chairman, if the farm was the same scenario, next or near or next to a lake, and it was not enrolled in Green Acres, the assessor would properly value the property based upon the highest and use value, highest and best use value, and it'd be classed as if, or excuse me, it'd be valued as if it were to be developed or to be sold as a seasonal property.
I think, Mr. Hagan, that's where I think we're encountering a lot of the misinformation about the legislative changes we made to Green Acres. I think in a lot of cases are more about some land being taken out of the ag classification and getting a new value than they are related to Green Acres. I think Senator Scoy and I talked about this. There really are two things going on, the changes in the values and then the Green Acres, and I think many people in the public are confused. Senator Scoy?
Mr. Chair, I think you're exactly right, and as a result of some of the Green Acres changes, there's been a number of parcels across the state that have been reclassified out of agriculture into what they should have been classified to begin with, and that's part of the discussion that's occurring right now as to, you know, how those parcels are going to be treated.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, this rings a bell about some things that have happened over the years. You know, I think it gets to be more of a subjective observation, maybe on our part. The assessor's supposed to be objective. And I have a hard time saying that just because something's a farm, it's not the highest and best use because there's a lake there. I mean, on a Minneapolis Athletic Club in downtown Minneapolis, not the highest and best use of the land, very expensive land, but if you taxed it at its highest and if you appraised it at its highest and best use, it could no longer afford to have it there. And subjectively, what does that mean in the whole picture? So there is subjectivity. I think when we do the policy making, we're being subjective while the assessors are trying to be objective.
Senator Dibble.
Chair, I think part of what we encounter is a language, a perceptual issue with language in some of these conversations. Highest and best, you know, implies a value judgment, not value in terms of numbers, but value in terms of principles. You know, so it's a you know, term of art or science. It's a well-established legal concept, so that's what we use, but I think that's what we run into when we're out talking to the public. Who are you to tell me that this isn't the best use of this land? You know, well, it's really not about that. It's about what has most potential monetary, financial value. So that's what we run into. We also have this whole issue of productive, unproductive, you know, in the farmland, you know, and we get caught up in some of those subjective valued conversations as well. I don't think we're going to turn around. We're not going to change the language, but we have to be clear.
Right.
What we're running into, it triggers some emotion.
The truth is the property tax does act somewhat like the income tax in that, you know, the more money you earn, the more income tax you pay, much like the more your property goes up in value as a net asset, the more you pay generally. And I think we all just kind of need to recognize that there is actually a progressive feature in the property tax system. Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chairman, if I could comment on Senator Dibble's comments. That's an excellent comment, I believe, too, that we are starting to run into a lot of problems where the highest and best use is a valuation concept that's well known by appraisers and assessors. However, when you tell a farmer that their property is not being used for the highest and best use, it does raise a lot of flags that it's really hard to deal with. Even though semantically that is correct, from their perspective, when you say it's not the highest and best use, you've already got a fight on your hands.
Much like the pharmacy on some main street somewhere who has a parking lot that is integral to their business, and really maybe the highest and best use of that might be another building, but for the business, the highest and best use is the parking lot. It's a functional part of the business.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Once the assessors discuss
to that point, Mr. Hagan, at some point in the presentation, are we going to talk about some of the CI valuations that gets around to the parking as we go through this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, and Mr. Atchison will be speaking.
Great, thank you.
Commercial properties shortly. Once the assessors establish the market value of the property, their next job is to classify the property based on the actual use of the property on January 2nd of the assessment year. And with a few exceptions, whatever use the property is being put to on January 2nd establishes the classification for the property for that entire year. The only exception being if the property goes from being taxable to exempt, that would be a variable, or if the property goes was non-homestead and becomes a homestead property, that could also affect the classification. Otherwise, whatever use the property is being put to on January 2nd does determine the classification of the property for the entire year. Now, occasionally, we have instances where there's one or more classes of property. If a person lives above a hardware store or things like that, which you may recall some of the years when we had discussions about borrowing, where you have a residential property above a commercial property, that would result in a split-class property. So the classification can be more than one particular classification at a time. In a couple of points on classification, too, it is really important to remember that a property owner doesn't get to pick what their classification is. Sometimes we've had a lot of pushback based on legislation where people want to either be classed residentially or seasonal recreationally, depending on which was most had the best tax benefits. The assessor should not ever choose a classification best in which has the lowest tax rate. They should base the classification, and they do, I would hope, base the classification on the actual use of the property. And the assessor's job is to classify property based upon the requirements found in statute. So after the assessor classifies the property and establishes market value for all the property, there are a number of different issues dealing with the frequency of assessment that they have to abide by. Each year, the assessor has to search out any new construction throughout their entire jurisdiction, and any property that adds $1,000 or more in value has to be added as new construction. Now, the assessor has an option. If it has less than $1,000, they can either add it as new construction, or they can leave it and pick it up as a part of the quintile assessment, which I'll speak about in a minute. At the same time, they have to look for any demolition or destruction of structures which add up to $100 or more in value, and they have to remove those values from the assessment throughout their entire assessment each year. And they also have an additional duty where they have to go out and search for property that was either omitted or undervalued. And this is a statute that's almost an oxymoron at work. If a property inherently escapes taxation, and that the land was not taxed and the structures were not taxed, so no part of the land was assessed, that would be a case of omitted property. If any part of the property is assessed, for instance, if the assessor missed a garage or a house, if any part of it's assessed, and here lies the oxymoron, it's called undervalued property. In the case of omitted property, where it totally escaped detection, which is extremely rare, the assessor has to go back for a period of, I believe, 6 years to recover the tax on that property. In the case of undervalued property, where a house or a structure was missed, the assessor can go back 1 year after December 1 of the year it was discovered or should have been discovered, which basically means they go back to current year's tax and a preceding year's tax. Finally, the frequency of the assessment is something that used to be called a quartile when there was a requirement in law that assessors had to review all property once every 4 years. That was expanded to a fifth year a couple years ago legislatively that requires assessors to review all property within a jurisdiction at maximum intervals of once every 5 years to the end that every 5 years all properties in that jurisdiction are reassessed. With that, I will turn the presentation over to Mr. Atchison.
Senator Squid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hagan, I think maybe now would kind of be the time you've gone through some of these assessment criteria. You know, we have a lot of different assessors across the state. And how does the department work to ensure that the assessing practices are uniform between these assessors?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, that's an extremely complex question. We try a number of different ways. Now, keeping in mind we don't have real direct legislative authority over assessors, we can recommend, we can advise, we issue letters and bulletins directing assessors to classify a property as a and the regional reps work very closely with the assessors and valuation. But at the end of the day, if the assessors choose to ignore our direction or recommendations, we really have little we can do about it, particularly in the area of classification. In the area of valuation, we have a State Board of Equalization which meets on it, and we can adjust the values a little more. And I do want to be real clear. It's certainly not a widespread phenomenon. For the most part, assessors work really hard to follow the law and do the very best job they can on classification. But if occasionally a an assessor does not follow the classification or do not classify properties according to statute, we don't have a lot of authority. We don't have a lot of direct regulatory authority to deal with that. And as you spoke about earlier, a good deal of the problems that have been commingled with this Green Acres discussion are not specific to the Green Acres debate, but a lot of the instances are issues where properties were improperly classified as agricultural, which during the process of correcting some of these properties, it's all got commingled in the debate about Green Acres, and it's created a lot of confusion and in some cases some very hard feelings with property owners.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Hagan, so the department, you know, you work with them the best you can, but you don't really have any authority to make sure it's uniform. A lot of professional organizations have developed professional standards, and they have continuing education. And is there anything there that develops uniformity between assessors that we could look at?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, over the years, we've added a great deal of educational requirements to the law. We've put in the MAO has or the State Board of Assessors has a very desirable and highly regarded licensure program for assessors. A county assessor has to be senior accredited, which requires, I believe, a minimum of 5 years of education. A part of that, a condition that every assessor has to take is the assessment laws and practices course, which is taught by the Department of Revenue. Additionally, the Department of Revenue teaches what's called a PACE course once every 4 years, which is statutorily required to deal with new laws and classifications of property. So I really believe that we do a good job. We, along together with the MAO, do a good job educating assessors. I think the education is there. I think people are knowledgeable of what they should do. The only problem I would suggest we might have is when people choose not to do it. And I could be mistaken, but I don't believe people are making a mistake out of ignorance. They're just maybe perhaps making it out of apathy.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to show that I haven't been on the tax committee for a few years. This goes back a long time, but I'm assuming, does the state board still use like a coefficient of dispersion? It took me so many years to learn what that was, and so I'm heartened to see it's still effective. Then, and he was nodding yes, they do. Did we ever resolve how we assess ag land? And I'm not on Senator Scoy's division, but property taxes were an interest of mine, but a lot like another lifetime ago. And I remember when I was – I'm going to share this story because we could use a little wake up here. I was chairing a property tax subcommittee in the House a long time ago, and we were out in western Minnesota, and a lot of farmers came to the hearing, and we talked about things like coefficient of dispersion and other things and crop equivalency ratings and soil surveys and all that stuff, and that's what I was going to ask you. And a gentleman afterward came up and told me I was pretty smart for a girl. So it was one of those moments you don't forget. So I'm just hoping that because I raised those topics here that somebody out here will also acknowledge. Anyway, but I wondered, do you have a uniform way of valuing farmland, for example?
It would be really nice if somebody in the audience would tell Senator Scheid that after the hearing so he would still feel really smart years later.
Mr. Chair, I think farmers from western Minnesota would say that was a compliment.
Oh, and Mr. Chairman, it was. I know that. I thanked him.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, Mr. Austin, we'll be talking about coefficients of dispersion in a few minutes. But with respect to your question about valuation of farmlands, one of the biggest problems that the department has and that assessors have is assessors are extremely good at valuing property based on its highest and best uses, that concept.
You're right.
They're extremely good at valuing property at what a potential buyer would pay for the property. Where the problems start to get encountered, and that brings us partly into the Green Acres issue, is what the proper value, when they measure what a property should sell for, they measure it against past market history and what other buyers have paid for this like properties. The difficulty on assessing farmland often comes in where the property is, again, my apologies for the highest and best use reference, but the property oftentimes is worth more if it were to be developed, sold, or it's worth more for hunting. Consequently, the highest and best use value is higher than the farm value. So the assessor is in a very difficult position to try to determine what the actual contributory value of the farm is. Now, the Department of Revenue has come up with quite a good method, I believe, of valuing the actual tillable farmland. The non-tillable land in particular is difficult to establish a value on because it is so hard under the best circumstances to determine what value woodland or property that does not produce a crop is worth to the farmer, and that becomes very, very problematic and the subject of a lot of debate.
Senator, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Scheid. To add to the confusion of valuing farmland and when you have these parcels that are being sold for really other uses than ag, even though they probably will retain the ag classification when they're sold, the parcel that's sold while it's leaving a farm and going or going off to seasonal rec, the classification occurs for the parcel, the category that it's leaving, the sales ratio, for the not the one it's going into. So it further confuses the issue of valuing ag land because a lot of the ag land is sold and then it goes to become residential or seasonal rec, and it's a very difficult valuation thing to come up with.
So it's still there.
Thank you.
Senator Double.
Mr. Chair, I think we can use the term highest and best use among friends here. We understand it. It's the language that we're stuck with. But I think when we're out in the, you know, talking to our constituents and in the larger public, you know, we get into a semantical box, and, you know, as we're talking to our constituents, we can talk about things like redevelopment potential or alternative uses that have a higher value, things like that, so that we get past that valuation, that values implication. Also, to make it clearer, make what we're talking about a little more clear.
I mean, yeah, I think you're right, Senator, but we all understand that, what that means here.
Right.
But
so no apologies needed.
If tearing grandma's house down and if the highest and best use is a Caribou coffee store, grandma doesn't think that's the highest and best
betcha.
Use.
Betcha.
Mr. Atchison.
Good morning. My name is Jim Atchison. I'm chair of the Commercial Industrial Committee for the MAAO. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you this morning. I'm a little embarrassed that I don't believe I've been in this building since I was in elementary school. So it was an interesting quick tour I had this morning. Mr. Chair and Senators, I do apologize. My presentation is not on the PowerPoint, but is on a two-sided sheet of paper that hopefully is somewhere in your packet. While you look for that, I was asked this morning to give an overview of the mass appraisal of and valuation of commercial, industrial, and apartment properties. My first point on the mass appraisal versus fee appraiser is assessors, and I'm going to refer to assessors and hopefully refer to them as assessors and not appraisers, although assessors are department heads and appraisers are those that are going out knocking on the doors getting the information. But assessors do mass appraisal where they're doing many, many properties at the same time, typically used in setting the valuation used for tax purposes, versus a fee appraisal is where an independent appraiser comes out and does an appraisal one at a time. Now, assessors do fee appraisals typically when they're defending values, local boards, tax courts, county board hearings, and that type of thing. But the majority of the information we're going to chat about today would be more in the mass appraisal area. As with all property, commercial, industrial, apartments, there are the three traditional approaches to value, the cost, the income, and the market or sales comparison approach. While all three are independent and can be used individually, all three of them truly are tied together, meaning that within the cost approach, you have to come up with both a land value and a building value. Typically, that land valuation is based from a market analysis. In order to do an income approach, you have to arrive at a capitalization rate, which is the income of the property divided by its sales price, which comes from the market approach. So all three of them are tied very much together. Strengths and weaknesses of each approach, just kind of high level here. The cost approach typically is used or is best to use on new or relatively new properties or unique properties. Typically sets the upper limits of the value and is the approach mimics the market in the sense that they're showing what the land would sell for at its highest and best use and what the improvements would be worth if they were built new today, and then depreciation is taken off from that. The income approach, kind of the underlying statement there is the quality, the quantity, and the durability of the income stream, which just means that how long has the property been rented for, whom it's rented to, is it a ma-and-pa grocery store, or is it a national tenant? Is the lease month-to-month, or is it a 10-year lease to a AAA-type tenant? It's a great approach and one that's used in mass appraisal quite often. It's a great approach as long as you have reliable income and expense information to go with that. Capitalization rates are typically derived from the market, although for some market sectors there are publications that can be purchased that give you indications of what that is. The biggest downfall of the income approach is it's extremely hard to obtain income and expense information. It is the assessor asking the owner-operator what they are getting for rent and what they are paying for expenses. So that's very kept very tight to the chest. The market approach is probably the most widely used and recognized. One of the benefits is the information, the sale prices are all public. They're easy to obtain. And the assessors have all the data, the statistics on the properties, the size, the qualities, conditions, and that type of thing.
Mr. Atchison, Senator Squire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Atchison, on the income approach, I had a mall owner in my office. Actually, it was Representative Bishop's daughter. And she had a question about this. You know, they use the income approach for valuing malls down in where she lives. And she was wondering what was going to happen now that the income streams were dropping off so dramatically. Would they continue to use the income approach on that mall, or would they shift over and use one of the other mechanisms, or what would be the process for that you would think would be used for that type of scenario?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, you would probably still, yes, use the income and the market, and probably would put less weight on a cost approach, being the fact that the drop in the income stream is a economic obsolescence that you would have to measure from the market and would be another subjective adjustment to that approach. So the cost approach would be probably put aside a little bit. Within the income approach, there's a couple of ways to look at that. The appraiser needs to look at the actual income to the owner, so many dollars of rent per foot type of thing. Where we're having some consternation now is the retail sales at stores have dropped tremendously. We don't necessarily put all of our weight on what month-to-month, year-to-year sales are for that specific tenant, but yet what they're paying as rent to the landlord. So if there truly is a reduction in rent that's being paid to the landlord, that should be captured, capitalized, and would indicate a reduced value, yes.
And Mr. Chair, do you have a highest value result that you're trying to get with these three factors that you use? I mean, how do you know when you've hit it just right? When it's the highest number that you're weighting these, or how does that work out?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, there are a few attorneys that say that we always aim for the highest number. There's a range in values in any property type. There's a range in values high and low, and in some properties that can be pretty wide. Others, it's pretty narrow. We are trying to be A, in the range, which would satisfy the Department of Revenue, and then B, we want to be kind of midpoint. We want to be too high. We don't want to be too low. But as important as where we are in the range is the equality, is that all properties, say all small retail stores and pick your jurisdiction, that they're all the same value, if they should be the same value. They're all the same size and quality and location, I think. They should all have the same valuation. So it's two parts, A, in the range, midpoint, as well as equalized across your jurisdictions. And that jurisdiction can go from city to city, county to county, and then the metropolitan area.
And Mr. Chair, just one more kind of question. So you have in your jurisdiction two pharmacies. One's a new, you know, kind of chain type, brand new building on the corner with a big parking lot. One's a two-story building on street. How do you come with any kind of comparable value to those types of businesses?
Well, that newer, Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, that newer drugstore in the corner would be about 15,000 feet, and it'd have a land-to-building ratio of about 4-1. Typically, they are on the best corner, the best location in any area that they are, and they would carry a value of around $200 a foot, approximately. Suburban Hennepin County, they would. And we're looking at that highest and best use is as a, you know, state-of-the-art pharmacy with drive-through areas, adequate parking, ingress, egress, et cetera. And we would look at properties that are comparable to that. Now, in a situation like that is where you have to step away from your city and go to a larger basis. It could be to the county or could be to the, in my situations, the metropolitan area, to get the information you need to value that, both from a cost approach and an income approach and a sales comparison approach, getting the rents and getting the sales on that. Your other situation of a drugstore, more Main Street, small town, we would look at that more as not necessarily that it's a drugstore in that, but that it's a retail, you know, facility, and would look at other comparables of small town Minnesota. And I mean, from my experience, the values are tremendously less.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, what about the parking lot around the corner store? How's that valued in relationship to the building?
Well, the corner store, the newer one, we would be looking at valuing the land and then adding a building value to that in the cost approach. And if we were doing the income or market, we would come up with a total value and then allocate so many dollars to the land and so many dollars to the building. One issue that we have with those chain department stores is that when they see a location that fits their demographics, they pay any amount of money it takes to move in there. We tend to, and I don't want to say ignore, but we look at other data to help us set that value on that corner, because what they've paid is sometimes 3, 4, and 5 times normal. So we would come up with a land value that you know covers that area.
Thank you.
Continue, Mr. Atkins.
Cost income market. I think I covered all that. Mass appraisal of income property. Commercial industrial apartment properties all fall into category of income, meaning that they can be owned and rented. Typically, in the mass appraisal of income property, I put parentheses around income, typically what we're referring to is apartment buildings and industrial properties. Both of those categories fit very well in the mass appraisal process, and we appraise these properties in spreadsheets and in computer programs that look at hundreds of properties at one time. We input the valuations or the inputs of income and expense and get a valuation. We use that as a tool. The appraiser still has to step back and look at those properties to make sure that they are worth the value that we have on those. Other areas that we can use income approaches more on an individual basis, we use pro formas. And those are, they can be on any type of property. They're a little bit more cumbersome and a little bit more specified and probably used more in the area of defending values, more of a fee appraisal type thing. Sales verification is a huge part of our job, and that is coming off the certificate of real estate values that are filed on all the properties. Within the residential properties, those CRVs typically are viewed under a clerical screening where a clerical person or individuals are looking at buyers, sellers, and the different boxes that are checked in the CRVs and making decisions if they're included or excluded from the study based on that. Within the commercial area, commercial industrial apartments, those are all individually reviewed. An appraiser would contact one of the parties to the sale, either by phone, stopping out and visiting them, whatever it might be, and asking the whys and the hows of that transaction and trying to get into the really the financial decisions of why the properties were sold and why they were purchased, and more importantly, why they paid what they paid. That information is really the basis of our valuation process in the metropolitan area, including Olmsted and Wright counties. We have an Assessor's Commercial Exchange, or ACE. It's a real-time web-based program that was developed in conjunction with Dakota and Hennepin County Assessor's Office and IT departments. And it's a database of all commercial industrial apartment sales in the metro area, real-time. And it starts with a CRV, and then the other information is filled in by the assessors. So we have a very wide database of information that we get our information from. Moving down the page a little bit, the valuation process would continue, really starts at the city level, and we stratify all of our properties, meaning that all submarkets react differently at different markets. Commercial acts differently than industrial, acts differently than apartments. But within each of those three main categories, within commercial, office reacts differently than retail, than restaurants, than automotive, and hotels. Within commercial, we look at different areas of distribution warehouses versus storage warehouses, manufacturing facilities, and flex buildings. Flex buildings are the newer type of industrial. They're flexible, and they can be anywhere from all office to very little office and more manufacturing. Within the apartment area, we look at the different submarkets with fourplexes, actually four and five units, and then really more from 6 units to 20, 20-plus units, and then 100 units and above. No different than what a residential appraiser would look at when they look at residential versus condos, townhouses, that type of thing. Trying to break the information down to the lowest level to get the best information and best assessment. In addition to all these, the property's age, condition, quality, location, and the assessor also has to be concerned with the highest and best use, as well as other economic factors such as supply and demand. In conclusion, what we're seeing in today's market for commercial industrial apartment properties, and this would be as of the January 2nd, 2009 assessment for taxes payable in 10, wide range of changes. In the apartment area, we're seeing fourplexes are down 20 to 25%. Apartments in the 7 and 11 size category are down between 5 to 10%, while larger complexes are very flat. And industrial manufacturing has been on a slide for several years, and it's continuing today where the values on larger, especially older industrial properties are down. Distribution is still fairly flat. Flex buildings, based on our time categories, is maybe flat to slightly above. In the area of office buildings, the larger trophy Class A investment properties are down considerably. Office condos, widely found all through Maple Grove, Plymouth, Medina, and Eden Prairie, are down also, and some of those are down considerably, between 5 and 20%. Automobiles, dealers, a little bit of difference between if it's a used car dealer or a new car dealer, and then it depends if it's a domestic dealer or a foreign dealer. We're finding the new car dealers of domestic manufacturers we're reducing those values tremendously, less of a reduction on the foreign dealers, and a flat valuation on used cars. Hotels typically are down.
Mr. Atkinson?
Yes, sir.
So if it makes a difference whether you sell foreign cars or U.S.-made cars, does it make a difference whether you're a Target or a Walmart?
Mr. Chair.
So it's not based on necessarily just on square footage, even if you're kind of selling the same product?
What we have found is that in our discussion with the car dealers is that the foreign car dealers have not seen hardly any drop in sales versus the typical Chrysler, Chevy, GMC, Ford have seen tremendous reductions. Several of the four dealerships have closed over the last 3-4 years in Bloomington, in Brooklyn Center, St. Louis Park. So there's a retraction of available product or of need out there, and the resales on those have dropped, or they haven't been able to sell. And we just had a sale of a Chrysler dealership in Brooklyn Center that sold for considerably less than what the assessed value was.
I mean, back to my Target Walmart example, if I remember the numbers correctly, Walmart actually made money in the fourth quarter of last year, but Target lost money. So does that change the value of their business property or not?
Mr. Chair, as I spoke earlier, and when we look at the income approach, we're looking at what properties pay for rent, not necessarily what the individual business is in their sales. So in your Walmart Target discussion, we would be looking, we look at those as the same. They're both discount retailers selling generally the same product. And at this point, we aren't looking so much at what their individual store sales are from year to year or corporately what they're selling. So in that case, we wouldn't. Within the automobile area, we have market evidence of dealers buying and selling car dealerships based on what dealership they can put in there. When I say that, car dealerships can only, there can only be branded dealerships within so many miles of each other. So if a dealership goes open, there's a limited capability of what dealership can even go into those locations, and if they want to go into those locations. In our discussions with several of the large car dealerships in the metro area, they are still looking for prime locations for foreign dealerships, not for their domestic lines.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Getting back to the discount retailers, does it make a difference if they own the property versus renting it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, no, it doesn't. I mean, we're looking at what that property would sell for in the open market, whether they're a tenant in the property or the owner of the property doesn't matter on the value.
Okay.
Actually, I was just gonna close with hotels are down typically metro area wide, and restaurants are interesting where the casual sit down restaurants are actually doing very well, fast foods are doing very well, and the higher price restaurants are doing actually very well. In general, restaurants are good. There are a few sectors that are a little bit with some location and maybe more, not necessarily the real estate, but just the type of food that they serve are questionable. But in general, they're still very well. And that concludes my presentation.
No opinions.
Questions of the committee? Mr. Austin, who's next?
Mr. Chair, Larry Austin with the Department of Revenue, Property Tax Division. I'd like to spend just a few minutes giving you kind of a brief overview of the sales ratio process and how we use that information for equalization purposes. Revenue runs three sales ratio studies each year, a 21-month study, a 12-month study, and a 9-month study. The 21-month study is used to calculate time adjustments that we apply to property sales. The 12-month study is used for equalization purposes, and it's also given to the tax court. And a 9-month study, which is a subset of the 12-month study, and that's also used by the tax court for appeals. The 12-month study is used for state equalization to ensure that assessments statewide are fair and equitable. The 12-month study looks at sales that take place between October 1st and September 30th of each year. Right now, the assessors are finalizing their January 2, 2009 assessments. So they looked at sales that took place between October 1st, 2007 through September 30th of 2008. That's one reason that assessors are sometimes known as historians, because they're looking at information in the past to set the current assessment rather than looking at sales that took place looking to the future to try to establish some sort of a future trend of valuations. A sale will be included in the sales ratio if it meets the definition of an open market transaction that reflects current market value. We only include good arm's length transactions, sales that have been reviewed and verified by the county and have also been reviewed by the regional rep for that particular area, and both groups, parties, agree that the sale is good for the study and should be included as a representative indicator of what's happening in the market. Information that assessors and revenue use comes from something called a certificate of real estate value. Jim Acheson talked about CRVs already a little bit. I do have a copy of a CRV here in the PowerPoint. And anybody looking at the CRV basically can see that the CRV tells the assessor or revenue who bought a piece of property, who sold it, when the property sold, what it sold for, the location of the property, if there's any personal property or seller paid points that would be included in that sale, they would be subtracted from the sale price to get an indication of what the actual real estate sold for. Item 6 on the CRV under type of acquisition, these are things that we kind of euphemistically refer to as automatic rejects. If one of those boxes are checked, there's a very good possibility that that particular sale is going to be rejected from the from the sale study, related party sale, children buying a property from their parents for something other than market value, a religious or government organization buying something for more or less than market. We want to get those types of sales out of the study so we can see what's typically happening in the market. If it's a partial interest, if I have a business partner and I buy out my partner and I buy basically just half interest and a CRV gets filed for that, it's not a reflection of the entire value of the property. So we don't want to use that type of sale in the study either. Contract for deed payoffs we don't use. Sales with new construction, physical changes we don't use in the study. If you had a situation where a property was improved with a house on January 2nd, house burned down in February, the property sold in March, but it was basically just a vacant piece of property, you would not have a good apples-to-apples comparison because the assessor's value in improved property, the sale is a vacant property. So we would reject that type of sale from the study also. We also can tell from the CRV if the sale is land only or if it's land and improvements. If the assessor, again, is assessing land only, but the CRV says land and buildings, you know there's some sort of a change that took place there, and there's a good possibility that sale should not be included in the study. We also look at the planned use of the property. If the assessor was valuing an apartment building, 40-unit apartment building, but the planned use is a single-family residential, it could be a good indication that that apartment building went condo. And so the sale is just reflecting one of those units rather than the entire apartment building. So again, we're going to reject that sale from the study. Under item 8, method of financing, we do adjust sales for terms. If it's a contract for deed or assumed mortgage, we will adjust it to reflect the terms of the contract or the mortgage. The bottom part of the CRV basically just tells revenue or the assessor, what county we're dealing with, what city or township in that county, the school district, the property type of the sale, and the value breakdown, land, buildings, total. There's also an indicator below that. It's kind of hard to read, but it says good for study, yes or no. When the assessor reviews the CRV and the sale, if they feel that that sale is a good indicator of what's happening in the market, they'll mark it as a yes for inclusion in the study. If the regional rep agrees, then the sale will be included in the sales study. If the county or city feels that the sale should not be included in the study, they'll mark it as a no, and then they'll give us a reject reason. And if the regional rep agrees with that reject reason, the sale will be rejected from the study. For each sale that takes place, Mr. Revenue Chairman. Does
Mr.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this certificate of real estate value, is there a reason not to include a checkbox that would be 1031, or would it, and would it be helpful? And you know, we had that discussion earlier about this. Would that be something? Because a lot of people just write it on there as a reason for sale. I understand.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I have to apologize. The CRV that we have here is a little out of date. The most recent one we have does have a box that does ask them to check if it's a 1031 because we are tracking those sales now to see how many of those we're getting and what the.
But that does not trigger rejecting this the sale.
That's correct. Yes. And it will trigger a review, but not necessarily reject.
So we did get that on last year, and it will be appearing, and you'll be using those in the future now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoey, all new CRVs that have been printed now have the 1031 exchange box on it.
That's great. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just a tiny bit hazy. Who fills this out, A and B? Is there an option to do all this online so that it's all kind of plugged in automatically?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, the CRV is usually filled out at the closing. So it's someone who may be knowledgeable of the sale, someone who may not be real knowledgeable of what's happening in the sale. That's why it's so important that the assessors verify the information on the CRV to make sure it's correct. It's especially true of commercial, industrial, and apartment sales because there's fewer of them, and you really need to have good information on the commercial, industrial, and apartment sales to determine if they should be in the study or not. If you get a bad residential sale that sneaks into the study, it won't tend to have as much effect on the overall process.
So,
Senator Dibble.
And is there are we mindful of trying to make a process like this more efficient and use some technology rather than just do paper forms, have some of them receive them and plug them in? We're thinking about that stuff a lot this year, trying to streamline our processes a little bit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that's an excellent question. We're working on an ECRV project right now, and it's getting to the point now where it's being tested. Hopefully Dakota County will be going live with that this summer. A couple of closers in Dakota County are currently testing the process to see how it works, what kind of changes they'd like to see made. And once that gets straightened out, I believe we're going to start doing some submitting it this summer. And once Dakota County is satisfied with the process, it'll probably go live to most of the metro and hopefully shortly after that statewide.
Great. Great. Thanks.
Let's see. What I'd like to do, if I can, is just go through a real simple sales ratio calculation and median ratio calculation. Since assessors use a mass appraisal valuation process to value thousands or potentially hundreds of thousands of properties every year, revenue calculates a median ratio to measure the overall assessment accuracy. A sales ratio simply is calculated by dividing the assessor's estimated market value by the sale price of the property. If a piece of property sold for $100,000, the assessor had it valued at $95,000, you have a sales ratio of 95%. 95,000 divided by 100,000 is going to give you 95%. For every sale that takes place, we calculate a sales ratio. We identify whether or not the sale is good or bad. If it's good, it goes into the study. If it's a bad sale, it's rejected. We put the sales into different property type categories. We run a sales ratio study for residential property, for apartment properties, for commercial industrial properties, for farm properties. And we also identify the city or township that those sales took place in. And we run an individual sales ratio for each of those districts statewide. I have,
Mr. Osmond, what does it mean when you say the sales are adjusted for the time relative to January 2?
The assessor values all property as of January 2nd of each year. The assessors are currently finalizing their January 2, 2009 assessments, which will result in taxes payable 2010. So what we do, we run the 21-month time study to get an indication of what kind of changes we're seeing in the market. Are we looking at a rising market, a declining market? And we come up with a time adjustment that's annualized. And then we adjust the sale prices back to January 2nd. So we have a good kind of apples-to-apples comparison between the assessor's estimate of market value and the value of the property as of January 2nd. So we adjust the sale price for terms. We adjust the sale price for time. So if a sale takes place in August of 2008, we would adjust it back to January 2nd.
But that does, in this market, actually artificially inflate a property's market value.
Senator, you're absolutely right. In this market, it does. It actually raises the value slightly as you move back to January 2nd and reduces the sales ratio. So it actually indicates that you should be increasing values in a down market. Luckily, with the process that we use, probably over the last 20 years, 17 of those years, we had an up market. And the process works perfectly well. But in a down market like we're in right now, assessors have to be really careful with that time adjustment and revenue also to try to follow what's currently happening in the market as closely as we can.
Continue.
Okay. So in this example, we have, we'll just say, a commercial industrial sales study. We have seven good commercial industrial sales in this study. We've calculated a sales ratio for each of those sales. So the next step is to calculate a median ratio, and that's basically the middle term in that list of sales. And if that median ratio is between 90 and 105%, revenue will assume that the assessment is accurate according to revenue standards and IAAO standards. The IAAO is the International Association of Assessing Officers, and our sales ratio criteria very closely mirrors their recommendations for sales ratio criteria.
And that's broke out by, that information then is broke out by what, the smallest taxing jurisdiction?
We will calculate a sales ratio for every property that takes place during the sales study period. We segregate them, as I indicated, by property type. The residential sales go into one group and the apartments and the CI. So in this particular case, this could be a commercial industrial study for the city of Maple Grove, or it could be Cottage Grove or St. Paul. We're going to have a similar type of analysis for every district in the state.
The most, with the smallest, I mean, so in a township or in a city, it doesn't contain, it's not a county number, for example.
Mr. Chair,
it's in the most local taxing jurisdiction?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Revenue looks at a minimum of six sales as a standalone study. If we have six or more commercial sales in Maple Grove or six or more residential sales in Maple Grove, we'll consider that as a standalone study and do the analysis on that. If there are fewer than six sales, there's a couple of other things that we'll look at. We'll possibly go back in time to see what they had for sales last year or the year before and then adjust those forward to kind of give you a little bit more sale activity to look at to figure out what the market's doing. We can also expand the market area a little bit. Maybe go to a city next door that's a similar market to try to get a little bit more information and use that to help establish the values. We'll also, we do what's called a small sample study each year where we look at what's happened in areas that had three commercial sales this year and two commercial sales the year before and two of the year before and three before that to get an indication of what's happening with market trends, with the values, if the assessors are keeping up with market or not, or if you know, possibly they need to make some changes.
So the answer to that is there does not have to be six sales in a city or a township to trigger a reappraisal of all the property in that taxing jurisdiction.
Mr. Chair, that'd be correct. Assessors do have an additional requirement to do the quintile reassessment that Mr. Hagan talked about. They're required to be on site once every 5 years to look at all property. But if we can identify an issue through the use of a COD, PRD, median ratio calculation that indicates that there are some issues or problems with that assessment, we can ask or even order the county or the city to do a complete reassessment for the next assessment to clean up any errors that we identify.
Even without six sales?
Mr. Chair, it becomes a little bit more difficult, but if we have a history of problems with a PRD or COD or low ratios, just consistently low year after year, it would be an indication to me as the regional rep that there maybe is a need to go in and look at everything. That doesn't mean everything's going to increase. Some properties may go down, but at least you'll have current information in the system to value the property.
Well, let me give you a Lake Vermilion example. There really are two townships on the lake. There's a lot of property for sale right now. If that stuff is selling below its market value, below the 90%, and there's not six sales in Greenwood Township, for example, but there might be four, and there might be four over in Beattie Township, the other township on the lake. Will that require a reappraisal of all of the property? Will the department order a reappraisal if those six, eight sales, whatever it is, even though they weren't in one jurisdiction, require, because things sold at less than 90%, which I think is probably happening, will the department order a reappraisal, even though the six sales weren't in that necessarily in the taxing jurisdiction?
Mr. Chair,
and I realize this is an unusual circumstance where property's going down, but that is, I think, what people are asking, is my property's going down in value, and they don't understand why they're not seeing some corresponding. They think their values, I think, are lower all of a sudden than what's on their property tax statement.
Mr. Chair, I would say we probably would not order them to do a reassessment in that particular situation, but we would expect the county to make some sort of overall reductions in value to follow what's happening in the market. You know, it wouldn't require them to go out and look at every piece of property, but you know, if you have three sales and you're overvalued on every one of them, to me that would be an indication that you need to draw down values a little bit, especially if you have additional sales in a neighboring township that shows you the same information.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the department have any random review of this, or what's your process for going in and looking at this besides the five-year thing that the county does? I mean, how many of these do you look at every year?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, we review the sales in every district every year. We run the sales ratio analysis for every district in the state every year. We analyze them every year. We have a state equalization that takes place every year where we review the median ratios, the CODs and PRDs, and try to address issues as they come up, either with possibly a state-ordered increase or decrease in value, if that's appropriate, or request that they make a reassessment of property, or if the median ratio and COD and PRD are reasonable, they're good to go.
As long as they stay within that 90 to 105, you assume things are going along pretty good in that area.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, that's certainly indication number one. If the median ratio is between 90 and 105%, we would say test number one has been met as far as assessment accuracy. Test number two would be to look at the coefficient of dispersion, which is basically a measure of individual sales ratios from the median ratio. And for commercial industrial property, a COD of 20 or less is considered good. You get into the 10 or 15 range, that's excellent. And that basically tells us that the sales are pretty tightly bunched around that median ratio. They have a good uniform, good quality assessment. If you have a COD that would be 30 or 35, it's an indication that the sales are spread out. You have outliers, extreme ratios. There's there could be individual property type, office condos that are causing a problem, or industrial property that's causing a problem, or it could just be across the board. And if it's an individual property type that the county can identify, then their task will be to adjust those values to get them in line with what's happening in the market. But if it's all property types and they're all over the board, then that's where we would get serious about talking about going in and looking at everything for the next assessment, reassess it, and bring the property values into line.
Thank you.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, sir, could you comment for just a moment about the impact of the foreclosures? Because a series of foreclosure sales in a neighborhood are going to impact the fair market value, but they're not included in the assessed value for your purposes, are they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, if you don't mind, as soon as I wrap up here, Mr. May's got some foreclosure information and document that he'd like to go through and talk about that. I can, but he's got it all put together. So.
I'll be patient. Thank you.
Okay, I think I pretty much beat the median ratio thing to death. In this particular example, we got a median ratio of 87, so for the next assessment, the assessor would have to increase some values to bring that median ratio up. But and I talked a little bit about the COD, coefficient of dispersion, and how we look at that as far as a measure of assessment uniformity and quality. The PRD is a price-related differential, and it's another measure of assessment uniformity. PRD of 100 would indicate that all property types are pretty uniformly assessed, high-value properties, low-value properties. A PRD of more than 100 would indicate that higher-value properties are under-assessed relative to lower-value properties. A PRD below 100 would tend to indicate that lower value properties are underassessed. So as part of the whole process, we do review the median ratio, the COD, and the PRD, and kind of go from there as far as what kind of action, if any, we would want to take. The last thing I wanted to mention was the Department of Revenue reject codes. As I think Gordon indicated earlier, the majority of sales are being rejected from the study. Over 50% of the sales are not considered good indications of market value, and they're being rejected from the study. The remainder are in the study as a reflection of what's typically happening. We've got 31 reasons for rejecting sales from the study. I guess we're kind of like the Baskin Robbins of equalization. They got 31 flavors, we got 31 reject codes. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I can if you want to.
Well, members, you have the page in your packet. There's a sheet of paper that has it.
Right.
Oh.
And
Center side.
Could you just say again what the PRD is? Price-related.
Price-related differential. As Senator Ortman mentioned, we've got an issue with foreclosure sales right now. What should we be doing with them and how we should deal with those sales? So unless you have any additional questions, I guess I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to come in today. And I'll turn it over to Mr. May, and he'll talk to you about foreclosures.
Thank you, Mr. Austin.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Tom May. I'm the Hennepin County Assessor, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, the Legislative Committee. I'm going to talk a little bit about foreclosures today, but when I do that, I always start out with a little bit of an impact thing to show kind of what's happening with foreclosures around the state. Also, what they're doing to the market, and I think there's a real good resource that I'll have here for you to look at how the foreclosures impact the market. The first resource is the Housing Link has a report that they do. This actually they did last year, and they projected through 2008, and they have a new one out now. But the important part, and I think it's interesting, I always like to point out that everybody knows that in the metro area, especially Hennepin, we have a lot of foreclosures. We had 7,500 in 2008. And if you look at their report, of course, we're number one as far as quantity. But if you look at per household percentages of who has the most foreclosures per household, it really shows a different picture, and it shows you that some of the outlying metro suburbs and even up to Mille Lacs have much higher percentages. So it really indicates that it's not just an urban problem. It's not just a Hennepin or Ramsey problem. It's really a statewide problem. And this is a great resource to go to because it does break down every county and show you what's happening in each county. This is a summary that they just put out showing the number of foreclosures. And I think if you look at that, you can see what's happening. If you look at 2005, we started with about 6,400 foreclosures statewide. And we moved up to where 2008 projections were 27,000. So tremendous increase. And I will say from the assessor standpoint, and when we talk about what we do with foreclosure sales, when we were down at a point when there weren't that many, excluding all of them was pretty simple to do. And the criteria just said that foreclosure sales are out, and we had plenty of what we call traditional sales to base the assessment on. And it was a much simpler world for us. What I'd like to point out especially is the market of foreclosures and how they particularly impacting the Twin Cities area. The Minneapolis Realtors has a great report, and I think you have the slides that will show some of it, but it is available online at mplsrealtor.com. And for the first time last May, what they did is they separated out all the sales listings and sales activity between what they call lender-mediated sales and traditional sales. The lender-mediated would be anything that the bank's involved in through some kind of a foreclosure situation, and the traditional would be the regular sales that we see every day. I think it's important when we look at this because if you hear national statistics, which all our taxpayers hear, you'll probably hear every couple months there'll be a Case-Shiller report. That's a nationwide study, and they use paired sales. And I think the last report came out a few days ago, and they said in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area that we were down about 18% year on year. If you look at this report, though, it sheds a different light when you separate out the two, the bank mediated from the traditional. It really shows that we have two markets that assessors are dealing with and, of course, buyers and sellers are dealing with. And the thing I want to point out on this slide is that actually in the last quarter there were 4.3% fewer new lender mediated listings than in the third quarter. It's the first time there's been a downward movement since 2003. So I don't know if that's a trend or if it has something to do with some of the mediation that's being done, but it certainly is the first time we've seen that. In fact, in the fourth quarter, they report that there's 600 fewer bank or lender mediated listings on the market. I will also say if you look at MLS statistics since July, the pending sales have actually been up over 2007. And in fact, in the fourth quarter, they're up 19.9% over the previous year.
Senator Schutt.
Second slide is the same. Yeah. The larger print is the same.
Oh, it does. Full figure, thank you. And I cannot see that. But do we know what happened to those listings? Are you coming to that? Are they just maybe not on the market?
We'll get to that in some of the detail when it talks about the sales in each community. The one thing with this new report, if you do go online to look at it, is they have a new capability to go actually into each MLS district. So you can go into the Camden neighborhood of Minneapolis and see the statistics on that, or you can go to any particular city that's in the metropolitan MLS. If we look at some of the information that comes out on the report, you can see that the red is 2008 and the blue is 2009. You can see in each category an increase in the number or percentage of lender-mediated properties that are in the market. In fact, overall, lender-mediated inventory in 2008 was 32% of the market, up dramatically over the 21% in 2008. And again, they talk about the 600 units that are down in the fourth quarter. This slide is also very telling because it puts the lender-mediated activity into value ranges. And it clearly shows that as the price of the properties increase, there's less and less lender-mediated properties in that market. So a lot of our lender-mediated activity is in the lower values. You can see that under $120,000, 71.5% of those that activity is bank sales or lender-mediated sales of some kind. You get over 250, 350 to 350, you see that it's down to 15.4. And in the upper ranges, it's down over $1 million, it's down to 3.3. Hmm. So there's a direct relationship between the price range and the amount of activity in that lender mediated. What does it do to median prices? And I think this is the one thing that everybody's interested in. And the one thing from an assessor standpoint that we certainly appreciate, an independent kind of study that points this out. Fourth quarter of 2008 saw a massive decline in lender mediated sales compared to 1 year ago. Well, traditional properties declined at a much softer rate. They're talking about the amount of decline in the median value. So if you look at the lender-mediated properties, it shows that from last year to this year, there was an 18.7% drop in the median sale price of those homes. But if you look at the traditional market, the regular properties, those dropped just 2.6%. So it's really too far apart markets. Now, I will tell you that this is averages across the metro area. So when you look at cities that have a predominance of foreclosures or some of our hotbed areas, traditional sales are probably going to be pulled closer to those lender mediated. So from an assessor standpoint, we're going to see for 2009 decreases that are very significant in those high foreclosure areas, and in other areas not quite as much.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Mr. May, that last slide gets right to my point, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but when you assess for only those fair market transactions, you're looking at those traditional transactions in order to value a house for assessment for property values, when there are all these other lender-mediated transactions going on all around these other transactions, and so the assessed value should more reflect the total on the left, that chart, rather than what's on the right. Am I right about that?
Maybe and maybe not, depending on the area. And I'll talk a little bit about
that.
This
isn't for sale, so.
I'll try to go through this fairly quickly. So median prices, 1 year change median price by property type. You can see that the traditional up there is a minus 3.5, and at the bottom of the lender median, it's minus 18.3 in the single family. So it's a trend. This is just a slide that has some of the causes, you know, what's caused the foreclosures, and I'm sure you've all seen this kind of thing before. But I always like to point it out because those are the reasons we're kind of where we are. The consequences to individuals, I like to add that that's also renters as well as the homeowners because of a lot of our properties. In Minneapolis, statistics from about the last year show that about 60% of the foreclosures are actually non-owner-occupied, so large impact on renters.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, I hope it's pertinent to point out that lender-mediated refers to short sales and foreclosures, but not any other kind of negotiating or workouts. Or am I correct?
We'll talk about that in a minute. It would include all those sales where the banks are involved. So it could be a short sale, it could be an REO sale after the sheriff's sale. Any of those, but if there's a workout where the people actually stay in the house, that doesn't become a sale.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, so this is all okay. So there's not. I just don't want anybody to think that there's mediation involved here. I mean, mediation, such as in a bill I have that would require lenders to mediate, to sit at the mediation table with the borrower. So there's nothing here. I mean, in some of those cases, some of those may be sold as well. But okay.
I think in this case that what they mean by mediated is the bank has some say in the sale of the property.
Okay. Thank you.
Last spring, to kind of deal with the foreclosure issue, the our state association, Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers and the Department of Revenue got together and developed an 8-page kind of paper to send out to all assessors dealing with the foreclosure situations and how we should deal with those as assessors and some of the issues about sales screening. Again, it's been mentioned that we're historians, so we're always looking back at what happened, not trying to look forward at what's going on. So our sales period's been kind of explained. It's October to October preceding. we always have this lag. And when the market's going up, you know, nobody complains about it, but now the lag's much more evident to all taxpayers. And last year in Hennepin County, I think it was the first time since 1978 that, at least as far as my records go back, that we ever had an overall decrease in residential market across the entire county. So we developed the paper, and it really, for assessors and for elected officials, and assessors share that with me, it kind of goes through the foreclosure process, describes it, and then talks about the types of sales. This is an overview of the process. Everybody's probably familiar with that, how the sheriff's sale works and the redemption period. The one thing I always like to point out is that at the sheriff's sale, prior to that, if the homeowner can work something out, they only have to pay the arrears. Once the sheriff's sale occurs, to redeem in your redemption period, you have to pay the total amount, all of it, including fees. So it really, things really change once the sheriff's sale occurs. Of course, I talked about the redemption period. It's typically 6 months for our property, so the owners can stay in the home 6 months after the sheriff's sale. I would say that there's some targeted areas, or if municipalities can show that they're abandoned structures, they can shorten that up. And farms actually are 1 year. Here's the type of sales, and to just put it in perspective, I think, Senator Scheid, what you asked. There's sales that occur pre-foreclosure. One's a normal third-party sale. That's just a sale where the property owner realizes he may be in trouble, may not be able to make the payments. They put the house on the market and sell it. To the assessor, we see that. It doesn't look any different than any other sale. And it's in our study in most cases. The second one is a short sale. And the short sale really only means that they sold it short of the mortgage. It doesn't necessarily mean it's short of the market. Because these typically occur prior to the sheriff's sale. The bank agrees to allow the owner to sell it for less than the mortgage, and it's put out in the market with all the other homes. It looks like all the rest of them, and when we get to CRV, it's from one person to another. It looks like a typical sale. The only thing we might see on a short sale is on the MLS listing, it may say bank approval required or lender to make final decision, something like that that would indicate that the bank's involved. In many cases, as foreclosures become more and more predominant, some of these sales are going to be in our study. We're going to look at these because they're more typical to the market. The deed in lieu of foreclosure isn't really a sale that we'd look at because it's simply the owner just giving a deed back to the mortgage holder and saying, you take the property and I'm gone. The sheriff's sale, of course, is not a sale as far as we look at it. It's just a transaction. The bank comes in and claims their rights and bids the amount that typically is owed. After the foreclosure, the typical sales are the bank sales or the REO, the real estate owned, and that's where you see the signs out and they say REO property. And those are just sold by the banks, many times through MLS. And these are the sales that typically we say are not included in our study. Auction sales also we see nowadays for large quantities. This is an overview of the process. Again, properties that sell during the foreclosure process usually do not meet the definitions of open market sales. Although, again, as we get more and more foreclosures, we may have to take closer looks at that. Some situations, foreclosure becomes so prevalent that they do create the market. We've had condo complexes where every sale is a foreclosure. We have a townhouse complex in Western Hennepin that every one is a foreclosure. So that does become the market. So there we have to look at that and act accordingly. The main thing, and I'll point it out, the last two things, and the one thing I'd like everybody to realize is the reason a lot of these foreclosure sales are not market sales is because of their condition. And assessors have to pay particular attention to the condition of the properties in these cases because there are not many foreclosure properties that we would call move-in condition. Just to give you an example, this is kind of what typically people think when they think about foreclosures. Boarded up homes, we have them, the mechanical's gone, the copper's stripped. We've had cases where a few of these have ended up in pieces out in the street because they've blown up. So it's a very difficult situation. But from an assessor standpoint, these really wouldn't represent market when they're sold because they're not of the same quality and condition that we'd want to measure the market by. Just to show you that it happens all over, people think it's older homes a lot of times. This is a house in a handover that last winter froze. And when that house sells, of course, it'll be selling at a tremendous discount, not be reflective of the market. We had another house in Mound that was actually a $1.3 million home that we think at this point now seems to have been fraud, but had 800 gallons of water run into that. This is a Brooklyn Park home that also had the same problem happen last year. This house, believe it or not, and sold originally on the CRV for $949,000. I'm not sure there's homes in that area that are at that amount, but it sold for zero down, but the seller did pay $10,000 of the points, so wasn't bad. Again, probably a fraud deal because it went to foreclosure very quick. But in this house, if you look at the inside pictures, the sheetrock that used to be on the ceiling is now on the floor. So again, when that house sells, there's going to be considerable problems and considerable remediation that has to be done.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tide.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, Mr. May, but I think that this situation is going to improve. Senator Foley had a bill last year, and the city, one of the cities I represent, Brooklyn Park, said they figure they've saved over 150 houses this winter because of the notification that his bill required utilities to tell cities when they were turning off the heat so that we don't have this happening. So it was happening, I think, in Champlain, Brooklyn Park, probably lots of places, but we had a lot of vacant houses. The city didn't know they were vacant. So that this should be better, but oh my goodness.
The cities are doing a much better job, and the banks are doing a better job. They're more cognizant of the issue than they were last year when it hit its epidemic. But we're working very closely with the cities as assessors. And in Hennepin County, what we do each year is we take our sheriff's foreclosure list in each city. We check with the city for information on these homes, and we try to go by them to see if there's issues with that so that on January 2nd, we can at least be as close as possible on our values on these properties. The last thing I wanted to talk about is fraudulent sales and the issue we're having with that. When the market was very hot and going up very fast, some of these sales that would come through, our appraisers looked at them and said, doesn't make any sense. It's still way too much money, but you know the market was moving so fast that way, it was hard to identify them. It's much easier looking back now to see which one of these probably had some fraud involved. I showed you the Brooklyn Park picture. There was actually one builder and broker in Brooklyn Park that had 37 brand new homes. They all went into foreclosure, brand new. So it is a problem not only with the old houses but with the new. The one thing I point out in the mortgage fraud end is there's two things happening. Mortgage fraud is against the lender, and that happens quite often. But predatory lending also is a big part of the problem where it's against the consumer. So both those issues are having a problem. Just one thing at the bottom to quickly mention, the FBI is working on it. Hennepin County Attorney's Office is working on this issue very diligently. They've added staff to try to do these cases, you know, to prosecute the cases, but they're difficult cases because there's a lot of paper involved in these fraudulent situations. But the FBI has a mortgage fraud area where they have suspicious activity reports. And the last report I saw, as you can see, in 2003, they had approximately 3,000 of them. 2008, they expected 60,000. So they're getting a lot of activity, and it's a very difficult process. So the answer is to how do assessors look at foreclosure sales? It's kind of a question of maybe some are in, maybe some are out, but they each have to be looked at individually, which is a huge, huge problem. I just want to leave you with one thing out of the realtor's report, and in the back of the report you can look at each city like I told you before. Just to give you an example, Brooklyn Center, which is having a big problem with foreclosures, in January 2009, their inventory sales, homes for sale, is 69% lender mediated or banks. Last year, 66.4% of the sales in Brooklyn Center were some kind of lender mediated sale, so a huge issue there. But in contrast, if you go to a city like Edina, 4.5% of their homes are lender mediated, and last year 8% were of that category that actually sold. So when you go from city to city, area to area, whole situation changes and the work of the assessor changes as far as the analysis. Thank you for your time. And if you have any questions, I'd certainly be glad to answer.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was reflecting on the realtor's report, looking at the proportion of sales and the fourth quarter of last year showing some signs of optimism, but I'm also remembering that the realtors made a presentation to the Housing Subcommittee, and we've also heard a lot of media attention about the second wave of these specific type of mortgages whose balloon payments are coming due in the next year, over the next couple of years, and we're looking at spiking up the number of foreclosures once again. So are we thinking about what's in the offing, that we're going to go through the kind of the very same round as we've just been through?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I don't know if I can predict that what you're talking about is the all-day type mortgages now that they see resetting
right,
the next
all-day.
Year and a half. They've made some estimates, and I've heard some dire predictions on that segment that, you know, a very, very high percentage of those could default. I don't know if that's going to be turn out to be accurate or not. And again, we kind of look at what's happened, and we're not trying to project forward. But certainly how we treat foreclosures and how we look at the market overall is a big, big issue for us right now. We're trying to deal as best we can with that.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
How do we, or how should we, or who should get an accurate read on how many of these Alt-A mortgages we have in our communities in Minnesota and try to do some predictions of how many of those are going to default? I mean, I think we should try to get our arms around it so we can anticipate some responses ahead of time.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That goes to my statements I was making earlier in the meeting. Mr. May, I think that the foreclosures are driving the market value on the traditional sales.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, you're certainly right. And when I mentioned the difference in locations, they're driving the decreases in Brooklyn Center to a greater extent than they're driving any kind of a decrease in some of the other areas like Edina that I mentioned. So as we go through the different cities, you'll see that the percentages will indicate how much that market's being affected. I would predict here that in Brooklyn Center, parts of Brooklyn Park, parts of Minneapolis, the decreases in home values are going to be double digit this year for 2009. In other areas, they're going to be very modest. So it's going to differ.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Johnson.
And the comments I made earlier, too, about my value dropping 25%, it's based on the foreclosures right in my neighborhood. So, and that, I took my house off the market last May when I seen this happening, and so I would agree with Senator Dibble. I don't think we've seen the bottom yet.
Mr. May, tell us briefly about the appeal process, and then we need to get up to session.
Mr. Chair, the...
Or Mr. Austin, who's ever going to talk appeals? It's on the last.
Thank you.
It's on the last page. Mr. May, Mr. Atkinson, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, John Hagan again. I will make this very, very brief. One thing that makes property tax very unique among taxes is the one tax you can appeal. A person is unhappy with the valuation or classification of their property, they can make an appeal to the. We encourage them first to appeal to the local assessor, the county assessor, which is usually the most effective means of appeal. If that is unsatisfactory, they can go to the local board of appeal and equalization and voice their appeal or concerns. It's kind of interesting to note, too, that several years ago, I think in 2003, the legislature realized the importance of local boards of appeal and equalization, and they instructed the Department of Revenue, the Commissioner of Revenue in particular, to develop a handbook for local boards that instructed them with best practices, what decisions they should make and shouldn't make, and we held training sessions. Since that law was implemented in 2004, we've trained in excess of 8,000 local board, local officials, and city officials. Realizing what a good concept it was, last year the legislature passed legislation requiring the department to develop a similar course, only different, for county boards of appeal and equalization. And working closely with the AMC, we went through our first year of that, and every county in the state now has a voting member of the board trained on proper procedures, what to do, what not to do, and how best to conduct a county board of equalization. So basically, the property owner can appeal to a local board, they can appeal to the county board. If they're unhappy, they can appeal to tax court. There's two levels of tax court, small claims and regular division. The small claims, here's values up to up to tax amounts up to $5,000 is quite informal. The regular division is much more formal. They require an attorney, and it's more, they stick more closely to actual rules of court. Make sure they're not
included. Any else, members?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ortman?
We're still trying to clarify Mr. May's comments. I think we're that, going back to one of his slides, that pre-foreclosure, the normal third-party sales are included in assessment, and short sales are included in assessments, but the deed in lieu of foreclosure is not necessarily included, nor are the bank sales or the auction sales after foreclosure. I just wanted to confirm that that's what he said, or that's what you're all testifying about.
Mr. Atchison?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I believe that that is a correct statement of what he said and the policies that we follow in our office.
Thank you.
Mr. Hagan, Mr. Austin, Mr. Volkman, very nice job. Express my appreciation to the commissioner. You did a very, very good job of giving us an overview. Members, we're going to reschedule conformity next week. I'm not sure what day yet. The Property Tax Division is meeting on Wednesday in this room, so it won't be Wednesday. Likely to be Tuesday or Thursday.
But we could just move.
So committee's adjourned.